Okay, so welcome to everyone. And unlike the last two, where I've asked you to do a lot of reading in the middle sort of section of the evening, we're back to the more sort of standard presentation and chit chat as we go along. So if you want to know what we're going to do today, we're heading towards Sinai. We're going to take a journey to Sinai and see at least if we can find out where it is and how to get there. I wanted to start by asking you to read the opening six verses of Exodus 19. So this is where we're sort of heading towards, but I thought we would read, first of all, the first two verses where it says they've arrived. It's taken them 18 chapters to get there. And then verses 3 to 6 of chapter 19. The most important, I think this is the heart of the book of Exodus. It's the reason for them going there. So have a good read and think about that for a moment. Exodus 19, 3 to 6.
And 3 to 6.
The last verse should be very familiar. Because, of course, it's repeated in the New Testament about us. We are also a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. But this was God's intention, his purpose, the whole reason why he brought them out of Egypt, why he took them on this journey, why he's brought them to Sinai, and what he's now going to do. So that if they obey him, then that all the nations, they will be his treasured possession. So that's the purpose behind what has been happening in the previous 18 verses and for them ending up at Sinai. But as I said, where is it? So one of the aspects of tonight is to realize that it's probably not where people have said it is. There's a traditional view,
Great.
and there's another more up-to-date version of where it actually is. First question though is, when did they start out? What is the date of the Exodus? And if you've done any reading on this or any Bible study where you've looked at notes, you'll realize that again, this is a subject of some dispute, certain amount of controversy. And there's two main views as to when it was. The traditional view of the dating of the Exodus is 1446 BC, which actually sounds very precise, and there's a reason for that, which I'll see in a minute. But the alternative view is that it's more like the 13th century. That, of course, is 1200 and something. You've got to get your head around BC figures working backwards. Okay. One option is 1225, which puts it very late, much further on. But the alternative view, anything in the 13th century is about 150 years after. So it's quite a difference in understanding. And it puts it in two totally different Egyptian dynasties. Now, I don't get bogged down in Egyptian history here, but the early view puts it in the 18th Egyptian dynasty, and the later one puts it in the 19th. Now, if you want to do more reading and thinking about that, that's fine. But I'll just point out one or two other facts about this. If you look at 1 Kings 6:1 now, this will show you why the traditional dating is what it is. So 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1.
1 Kings 6.
Bit of detective work here then. So what's the clue in that verse that might help us decide?
4th year of Solomon's reign.
And what about it?
Well, presumably that's more precise.
Well, the one saying, does it say anything about the Exodus in that verse?
Yeah.
Good. What?
480 years before the fall.
Right, okay. Now, you may have a footnote reference, which might even say, oh, it's not 480, it's 440, and so on, because the Septuagint has a slightly different version of it. But if we go back 480 years before the fourth year of Solomon, which is fairly sort of datable, then that is how you get back to this traditional date of 1446. Solomon's reign was, or this part of his reign, was around about 966 BC. If you remember that David was about 1000 BC, and then 40 years later, Solomon, and then you get to about 966 BC, and then you knock off 480, and it gets you back to 1446 BC. And there's quite a bit of archaeological evidence to support this date. The reason why the Septuagint might knock it back another 40 years is the point about it is that it's done in terms of generations, and 40 years was regarded as a generation.
Yeah.
So 480 years is 12 generations. So if then the alternative is 11 generations, that does make a difference of 40 years. So that's another particular sort of discrepancy that might come in. That might be a translational manuscript sort of thing between the 12 generations and 11. But that gives us this traditional date. And that, again, I don't want to dwell on all this sort of pharaoh stuff, but that puts it in the reign of this guy, Amenhotep II, who was the seventh pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. And so on. However, and although that fits lots of other things, like any evidence that there is of Joshua's conquest and so on, and it fits all sorts of other things, which we'll have a look at. Perhaps we'll have a look at that now. Let's just... Yes, if you have a look at in Exodus 3, before all this Exodus thing got going, Moses spent 40 years in Midian. So in before the burning bush episode in Exodus chapter 3, you've got towards the end of chapter 2, if you remember what happened, Moses sees someone, an Egyptian, beating a Hebrew, and so he kills the Egyptian, and then he realizes he's been spotted, so he has to flee. So he actually goes to live in Midian, and then his life develops there, and we'll look at the significance of that later. And he marries there and settles down, and he tends the flocks of his father-in-law Jethro. But in verse 23 of chapter 2, it says, during that long period, the king of Egypt died. And what that is telling us is that all the time that Moses was in Midian, there was one king, one pharaoh on the throne. And so Moses was sort of stuck out there waiting for that particular period to come to an end. And if you look at the dates of this pharaoh that I've got on the screen, you'll see that it does cover a long period of time. I hope I've got the dates right. I'm not going to say an expert in this. but he did have to wait a long time while that particular pharaoh died. Actually, now think about it. It was the previous pharaoh that had to wait until he died. That's right. And then this one took over. Now, the other interesting thing about the dating, I don't want to spend too long on the when, is in chapter 1 and verse 11. In Exodus 1, verse 11. And this is where there's a slight sort of fly in the ointment, if you like. Why is there an alternative at all? All the evidence seems to point to this traditional date, and yet there is an objection. So in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 11, it talks about the work that they were forced to do when they were slaves. It mentions two places that they built. Can you see where they are?
Yeah, sorry, I've muted everybody because there's a brown noise. Okay, you're unmuted unless you've muted yourself.
So in chapter 1 and verse 11, it talks about what they did. They built two places, the store cities.
Ithon and Ramesses.
Yeah, and we're going to think about the importance of those again a little later. But the evidence is that this place, Ramesses, wasn't started to be built until around 1300 BC. That's what the historical records seem to suggest. And in fact, it wasn't really finished until a guy called Ramesses was the pharaoh, and he obviously renamed it after himself. So if they were busy building these two places, that does rather suggest this other date of 1300 or 1200 and something. So that's just to say a slight fly in the ointment as to why there is this alternative date. But if you want to go into that in more detail, please do in your own sort of time. More important that for us now is to think about, I've just explained that bit, is to try and look carefully at some of the places involved. Now, can you see on that map the two places we just talked about? Ithon, although it's written with an N there by the looks of it, and Ramesses. So that shows you the land of Goshen and where that is in comparison to the rest of Egypt and where the Israelites were when they were about to set off. But we said that Moses fled to Midian in Exodus 3, verse 1. And really carefully, when he was there tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, where did he take the flock to? What place? Yes, no, which is a mountain, the Mount of Horeb. And Horeb is the same as Sinai. Well, it may not be exactly the same peak, but it's another mountain in that particular area. And Moses, as we said, has fled to Midian, which is in northwest Saudi Arabia. It isn't in the peninsula that's now called the Sinai Peninsula. So if Moses' original fleeing journey was a sort of prefiguring of what was to come, it makes a lot of sense because it means he's already sort of seen where to go, knows what it's going to be like and how to get there, and he spent some time there. And there is the mountain of Horeb. And how do we know it's the same as Sinai, by the way? Do you remember anything else that happened at Horeb? Who else went there?
Didn't Aaron go there?
Aaron?
Yes.
He might have done. When was that? Well, I mean, he would go there. Do you mean he would go there beforehand?
Well, I think he must have met up with...
You see, when he eventually met there, yes. Now, I'm thinking of much later on, someone who fled, escaping a vicious leader again, and went to the mountain of Horeb.
David?
No, I'm not thinking of David.
No.
I'm thinking of Elijah.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And he went into his cave. And he was fleeing from Jezebel. And he met with God in that cave at Horeb. that Moses and Elijah both had time at that same mountain. In fact, later on, we're going to see that someone else, quite possibly, a bit of a surprise, was also there. But I'll tease you on that one for a bit longer. But already we're getting a clue that if Moses' initial journey was to this place, Midian, which is coming up in a minute on a map, like, whoops, there, then you'll see that he had to go all the way from where Ramses is, it's still on that map, to get across out beyond the Sinai Peninsula into the land of Midian, which is where Mount Horeb was described as being. Now, why did he have to go that far? Well, presumably, in order to escape completely from Egyptian control, he had to get out of the Sinai Peninsula, which I'm told, again, not being an expert on all these things, that often changed hands. But if it was under Egyptian control, then he would obviously have felt it better to keep going and end up crossing the Gulf of Aqaba, or going round it in some way, and going to the land of Midian. And that's where Horeb is. And therefore, that's where I'm going to suggest that Mount Sinai is, not where you can see it on that map, which is the traditional site. Okay, if you can see at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, it puts Mount Sinai there. Now, there is a big mountain there, and that is the traditional site. And I'll explain why it's become the traditional site again a little later on. Now, in order to get there, it would take Moses about 9 days. Journeys like that were not measured in miles, they were measured in days. You know, the time taken, and you didn't travel at night. Roughly, you could do 25 miles a day. It would vary a little bit. Now, if you think what's going to happen, if just jumping ahead a little bit, the journey that Moses and the Israelites was going to take in the Exodus was meant to be a 7-day journey. That was the plan, the cunning scheme, because they said, he said to Pharaoh, we're going to go 3 days into the desert and then spend a day worshipping and then coming back again. So they basically had sort of said, we're off for the week. Now, Moses, if he knew this journey, if he knew this map, if you like, this way he could go, he knew that within 7 days he could get close to where he wanted to be, and that's where there'd be more fresh water. So they only needed to take enough supplies for 7 days, or that looked like 7 days, but he knew that instead of stopping for a day and going back again, if he kept on going, then he would end up the other side of Sinai, where he wanted to go. And please be aware that the Israelites, and Moses in particular, and in fact all of them, although they were slaves, it didn't mean that they were weak. They were quite fit and healthy. They'd been well fed, and they were kept in good condition, so they could work harder. So these are not sort of emaciated, weak people struggling to to make a journey of any length. They might be quite slow at times, but they could make that sort of journey quite easily. This also is Moses' journey, suspected journey, from the Goshen area across and round and the top of the Gulf of Aqaba into there. And you'll see on that particular map that Mount Sinai is now placed in Midian. In fact, you've even got Jethro's house there. I can't guarantee the accuracy of every single map I put up. It's simply intended to give you visual aids, and you can find your own maps later if you really want to. So that was Moses' initial journey, and one that was going to be followed later by the whole Exodus in some form to end up in roughly the same sort of place, if that's what we believe that it was. Now, we looked at the date, we looked at this aspect of it. Here's another question. How many people were there in this big mass movement? Anyone, any ideas? Anyone can fling a figure out at me?
About 600,000.
Good. Where did you get that from? Just remember it.
Yes.
Well, there's the passage to look up if you want some details. It's in Numbers chapter 1. Not surprising, it's in Numbers, because it's all about numbers. Don't sort of read it all, but have a look at it. And you'll see that by the time you get to verse 46, you get this number of, well, 603,550 fighting men. I'll show you in a minute that the same number crops up somewhere else. But if you want to do the maths at any point, that total comes from adding up from verse 21, the number from the tribe of Reuben, 46,500, and then from Simeon, 59,300, and so on. And I'm told, because I don't think I've checked it myself, but I'm happy to believe it, 603,550 fighting men. But that's only the fighting men. Okay, no, there would be fit and able men, but there would also, of course, be women, children. And so, therefore, the general sort of boosted figure from all this is at least 2 million. Mm-hmm. Maybe more, maybe 2.5 million, maybe 3 million.
Someone said some of the Egyptians would have come with them.
Yeah, and that's something I'm coming back to right at the very end, because I think that's very, very interesting. So we don't know how many, and I'll show you that verse later on when we get to there, because I think it is very interesting. But at this point, we're saying the number is big, and who knows how big, if from here it could be even more. There's a couple of other verses. Numbers 2:32 just simply comes up with the same figure. And the one that you might have remembered from Exodus 12, I think that just says about 600,000. So Exodus 12:37, there are about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, go on.
It's just, it all comes from the 70 people that go into Egypt in the first place.
Yes.
So what sort of exponential is that over that 400-year period?
Pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about this in a minute. Oh, so keep your question in mind. Do some extra things about it in a minute, because I'm going to, it's likely the dates, some people think that the figure can be different from that. While you're looking at Exodus 12:37, as you've already mentioned it, it's verse 38 that says many other people went up with them. Okay, so that's a lot. Now, 600,000 fighting men, and it says in Exodus 13 as well, they were armed for battle. That is a huge, huge army. It's about 10 times bigger than most armies that ever fought at places like Waterloo under Wellington, things like that. It would be far more than the Egyptian army would have. So why does it say in chapter 14 they were terrified of them? And why, when they eventually got into the Promised Land, could they not defeat the Amalekites, for instance, which were much smaller? Well, maybe God sort of made sure they didn't, because they had to rely on him. That was the whole point of it. Think back to Exodus chapter 1 and verse 15. It's one of the reasons where this problem all started was, yeah, Pharaoh was getting worried because there were a lot of them. They were quite worried, Pharaoh was, that they were going to be overrun by them, or at least in that particular part of it. And it all goes back to the fact that they ought to kill the babies. Now, how many midwives were there?
Two.
Two is not a lot of midwives if you've got 600,000-odd men with their wives and families. Only two midwives? Deuteronomy says God chose them as they were the fewest, not the largest. And God also said that he would help them take the land because they weren't strong enough to do it, and so on. So we do have this thought. Again, you might think, oh, this is sort of scholars doubting what the Bible actually says, that maybe this is too many. And if you think about it, 2 to 3 million people on the move is massive. If you've got any idea of things like sort of Wembley Stadium, how many that used to hold, and imagine whatever it is, 20, 30, 40 of Wembley stadiums all coming out at the same time and all moving off, it is massive. Someone has calculated, can't verify this in any way, but even if you're 100 abreast, 100 across, and there's about 2 to 3 million of you, and you've got to allow some space for people to move, particularly with their animals, it would be 5 miles long. Okay, it'd be a block with going back 5 miles, even if it's just 100 abreast and so on. So the figures are staggering. Is there any way sort of around this, shall we say, without wanting to sort of doubt what the figures actually say? And that is that the word that's used for thousand, LF, can also mean clan or family. So if we're looking back in Numbers chapter 1 again, it's the best way to try and explain this. I'm not saying you have to accept this or believe it. I'm just explaining how people look at this. So back in Numbers chapter 1, remember we said from the tribe of Reuben, there was 46,500. That's the number that comes up there. Mm-hmm. But if the word that's translated as thousand there is actually translated as clan, then what that is saying is that from the tribe of Reuben, there were 46 clans with 500 fighting men from those 46 clans. In other words, it isn't one number, 46,500. It's 46 clans with 500 men able to serve in the army and so on. Now, that would be about 10 per clan, which makes some sort of sense. We haven't got time to look this up, but this word LF occurs many times where it is translated as clan or troop. In other places, it is translated as 1,000. So it's a word that has sort of two uses. And if in Numbers chapter 1, we treat it as clan rather than family, clan rather than thousand, this number eventually reduces to about 5,550 fighting men. That's by going back and saying there's 46 clans, 500, there's 59 clans, 300, and so on. And then if you boost that up by women and children and so on, you might get more like 20,000 instead of the 2 million. So that's how an alternative smaller number gets mentioned, gets thought of. So I'll leave it with you. If you want the bigger number, fine. Logistically, it's quite complex, but it could be right. Or it could be this smaller number. Now, I don't know, so that helps the question about the exponentials thing, whether that makes more sense of 70 over 400 years becoming more like that number. So, yeah, are you going to say something again?
Yeah, it's just that when Moses was the baby and put into the Nile,
yeah,
there was a policy that the male children had to, were filled.
Yeah. So
was that policy ever stopped? Or, because I would have thought that would drastically
well, reduce the number. The midwives refused to do it, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, to what extent that order was carried out, how many actually did die that way, because if you remember the midwife sort of lied to Pharaoh and said so after that he gave the order that they would be thrown into the Nile. You factor that in somehow as well, which adds another unknown to it.
I heard somewhere that the Egyptians were slaves, so they weren't fighters.
Yeah.
So they might have had the armaments to fight.
Yeah.
Under the Egyptians, but not really known how to use them to effect.
Well, maybe, but one of the reasons why you'd be terrified of them is they did have chariots. In other words, they did have more of a sort of fighting force. But how many of them did, whether that was just like the king's special forces, if you like, that eventually went charging after them, I don't know. One of the interesting features of this is that the whole Exodus story is not recorded in Egyptian history, which of course makes some people think, oh, the Bible might have made it all up and all the rest of it. The other option, of course...
Egyptians are ashamed of it.
Of course, they're not going to record this event. It was a disaster for them. They don't want this to be known, and so on. Anyway, so we've got problems, debates about the date, about perhaps the numbers and so on. And now we actually need to think perhaps about the journey. Now, the journey took place in stages. And if you want, you can find in Numbers 33, verses 3 to 9... the short version. Okay, the summary. If you want the whole thing, it starts in Exodus 12:37, which we've already seen, and goes on to chapter 15, verse 27. So in Exodus, you get the more detailed picture. In Numbers, in about 7 verses, it just takes you through the various stages. And really, there's only one difference in those two accounts, which is probably a translational thing as to whether a place is named after its Hebrew name or its Egyptian name. But one thing is clear, in both cases, they leave the same place at the same date. And they leave Ramses, this store city. The place Ramses still exists. It's now called Qantir, Qantir. And of course, they left on the 15th of Nisan. I say, of course, because it's the day after Passover, which we hopefully all know is the 14th of Nisan. So they leave Ramses, which is a known place. Mark that on the map, no problem. And they end up at Sukkot. Yeah, that's the second place. That's also a known place. It's now Tel El Mashkuta, which is about a day's journey away, or it could be the first stage of it. And after that, all the other places have become lost to history. In other words, all these other names, even the third one, which is Etham, E-T-H-A-M, is now not known at all. It's a lost site. If we knew where that was, we'd be able to decide better what the route would be. But because after the first two stages, we don't know anymore, the next problem with this whole story is we really don't know how they travelled after this. Now, that's the traditional route of the Exodus, which takes them to Mount Sinai in the Sinai Peninsula. So I put that one up. But remember, the moment they've sort of left the Nile Delta area, we don't know in which way they went. That looks like some more possibilities, but you can find your own maps on this. I'm only giving you a sort of snapshot on all of this. You'll notice that there in the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, they've put Jebel Musa. Jebel Musa is the name, the Arabic name, for the Mountain of Moses. Okay, so that mountain is known as the Mountain of Moses. But again, only traditionally, it's not like, you know, he sort of carved his name there. Moses was here. That settles the matter. And I've probably got another one here. Oh, some more proposed routes for the Exodus. Okay, various theories. I'm only showing you here just how complicated the whole thing is. if you want to do a dissertation on it, well, there you go, starting point for you. Now, the interesting bit in all of this is we know that they crossed the Red Sea. So that might help us if we can understand where that was. And this is in chapter 13, Exodus 13, from about verse 17 onwards. So Exodus 13, verse 17 onwards, is where we're going to pick up the story. And it says that God didn't lead them on the road through the Philistine country, although it's the shortest, because they might have encountered trouble there, and so on. And eventually, I suppose we need to go a bit further into chapter 14. They eventually arrive at what's been called the Red Sea. Now, you might know this, and particularly from your footnotes, there's a problem with that as a translation. Okay, the Hebrew Yam Suf. Yam certainly means sea, but Yam Suf is now better understood to be the reed sea. So it doesn't help to actually use the term Red Sea to try and pinpoint anything geographically. Maybe we're looking for something that's a Red Sea. A Reed Sea. But the Red Sea is a very large sort of area. I don't know whether these maps come up very helpful. Yes, there we are. The Red Sea is all of that. And then, of course, it splits around the Sinai Peninsula into the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba. So both of them sort of qualify a little bit for being part of the Red Sea. But the idea of it being called the Red Sea is simply because at times it sort of glows a bit red, either from the sunlight or because there's red coral that can be seen. So it's a name that has stuck, but it's stuck for the whole of that body of water. It isn't just a little bit, and therefore you can pinpoint it and say, oh, that's what where they crossed the Red Sea. But of course, it wasn't the Red Sea, it was the Reed Sea. So people then look for sort of marshy areas where there's lots of reeds growing. Well, that might be useful. There are places like that. That might account for where they actually crossed. That might help pinpoint the journey and see where they went to. I've already said that, remember, they would get themselves equipped for a 7-day journey. And after 7 days, they'd be looking for further supplies. And the first fresh water they would come across would be at the Gulf of Aqaba. And there's very good reasons, but again, scholars debate and people investigate and find all sorts of things. It's still an ongoing sort of investigation. Does it fit the rest of the geography? Because we know that the Israelites felt trapped at one point. They wanted to turn back, but they couldn't. They were trapped by the sea, by the Egyptians behind them. But equally, the Egyptian couldn't get that near at that point. But it looks as though a better option for a crossing point is somewhere around the top bit of the Gulf of Aqaba, which would take them back into Midian, which is where Moses went, and he would know that you could pick up fresh water in the Gulf of Aqaba. And then presumably he was going to take them around or find some way past there, and then they found that they were trapped. So there's no option but to keep going, which meant to cross the Red Sea. The word Yam, which is best translated as sea, always meant a deep body of water. It didn't mean just a shallow lake or a bit of marshes. So people that think it's sort of way back earlier on the map, that it was part of these bitter lakes or the other things like that, you wouldn't really call that Yam, a sea, and so on. And if you think how God actually did this miracle, and at some point, why not read it again? and just actually put yourselves in the shoes, or rather the sandals perhaps, of the Israelites at this point, what it would have meant to be faced with the Egyptians behind you and this big body of water in front of you, and to watch what God did. Because he did send this strong east wind, and you may have seen films of this and wondered, you know, how accurate the films are, but it does actually say in the scriptures that God created two huge walls of water. And the Hebrew word homar, for wall, doesn't just mean a little wall like you and I tend to know, but the sort of wall you get defending a massive city. In other words, really big, massive, and so on. And when eventually Pharaoh's forces are hurled into the sea, they are hurled into the depths, the deeps. So the waters come back again, and it really is deep. So the chances are that it's somewhere around this northern bit of the Gulf of Aqaba, which actually fits in with Josephus' description, our friend Josephus, who often, well, exaggerates a little bit and doesn't always perhaps describe things that accurately. His account of this does fit very much the coastline of the Gulf of Aqaba, where there are extremely rugged mountains and very high, and where they would feel trapped in, and so on. Now, so although there is still some debate over where the Red Sea actually is, and therefore part of the part of what the route is, why have we got Mount Sinai in this traditional place in the Sinai Peninsula? And incidentally, can you see on this map that in Midian there's another mountain called the Mountain of the Law? Yeah, see that? The Mountain of the Law on the right of the screen, which is Jebel al-Laws. And so therefore that particular mountain has also been associated somehow with the law being given. So that may well be the more realistic site. But you've got this traditional site called Jebel Musa on the on the Sinai Peninsula, because eventually people, you've heard of Constantine, obviously, you know that when he was converted, his mother went to the Holy Land and decided to find all these different places. And she said, oh, that's the grotto where Jesus was born, and that's where the Holy Sepulchre should be, and all this sort of thing. So around that time, after Constantine's conversion, people, like his mother, went around actually saying, oh, that's where this happened, that's where that happened. And tradition says that she, or maybe another group of people, went to that place and found some monks living there, and therefore decided this must be the spot. So she commissioned a small church there. And you might know that now there is a monastery there that's been there for centuries and so on. And so tradition has built up over the centuries. In fact, it was in the 6th century that a huge monastery was commissioned to be built there, called the Sacred Monastery of the God-Trodden Mount Sinai, if you want its glorified title, but basically known as St. Catherine's. So that was built there in order to support the tradition. Okay, but there's no evidence that anyone before then actually believed that that mountain was Mount Sinai. But it's a good tourist attraction, like a lot of these places. But perhaps then, as I've said, if the place of crossing was the Gulf of Aqaba, which does fit lots of the texts and the evidence of it, then it does mean that Mount Sinai is in what we now call Arabia, northwest Arabia, in the land that was known as Midian. And there's quite a few. The reason I got into this is because I've come across some books which now explain this and explain it very thoroughly and carefully. And I'm talking about books written by real Christians who are interested in, you know, finding out the truth and all this and slowly digging back through the traditions. So maybe instead of what's now called Mount Sinai, this mountain that they went to is this other place, Jebel.
Yeah.
own laws. And it's not one mountain, it's a range of peaks. And it one of them is actually called or known or so it fits the idea of Horeb. And its higher peak would be the actual Sinai bit that Moses went up, if you like. Because there's a range of different peaks and some are much higher than others. People have tried to work out how much of the textual evidence would fit this particular area and find that actually a lot of it does fit. There are caves there. Well, that's not too surprising. Most sort of mountain areas like that have caves. But that would mean that that could well be where Elijah hid away. Satellite images show that it to be a very volcanic area because the rock is very dark. So that would fit the fact that all the smoke and fire and so on that happened around there. And then people pick up the fact that around that place, there needed to be somewhere where Moses set up an altar. And they try and find evidence for that. Maybe even where the golden calf was actually sacrificed. And in fact, they found a graveyard where about 3,000 people had been buried about 3 miles to the east. And if you think about what happened after the golden calf incident, 3,000 Israelites were put to death there. So maybe they found the burial site nearby. And another feature that's mentioned in Deuteronomy around this time is there's a brook, and there is a brook, and it's very rare for there to be a small stream of water around there, but there is in this place. And there's also this what's called the split rock, which would fit the text where it talks about Moses splitting a large rock, and there's a feature there. Now, how much you want to think that's conclusive, or how much of that's just interesting, maybe circumstantial, again, that's up to you and part of what's being investigated. So I've got one more little thing to say on this, but I've gone on for quite some time now. Any questions or thoughts on all these various things?
Can I say something, please? I've actually been on the route that the Israelites took into Egypt along a wadi with the mountains towering up either side, a huge wadi with towering mountains. And at the end of this wadi, you come to a beach called Nuweiba Beach. And if you look on a satellite photograph of the area, that is the only possible beach that they could have come to contain that number of people to cross over into Midian, into Arabia.
Right. Can I just clarify something? Because I don't know if I misheard you, what you said. You said you had followed the route when they went into Egypt. Did you mean
we were in Israel, and then we went down towards the Red Sea.
Right, okay. And
then went, actually crossed over the border into Egypt, down to where the possible site would be.
So you didn't go to the Nile Delta?
No. We didn't follow the whole route.
You went down towards the Sinai Peninsula.
Yes.
Right. And then you're telling us you found this wadi, this beach type thing.
Which we went along for quite a long way.
Right.
And it fits the whole description in the Bible with the towering mountains either side.
Right.
And at the end of it, you come out into a beach, which on satellite picture is the only possible beach that, you know, they could have come to.
And that's on the western side of the Gulf of Aqaba.
Yeah.
And it would show that they would be trapped there by the Egyptians all around.
Yeah, and I understand that at that particular point there is a sandbank underneath the Red Sea, because if the sea parted at that point, the Red Sea is actually very deep, so they would have fallen down into a huge sort of chasm, if you like.
Yeah.
But because there was a sandbank there, they only had to go down a short way and across on this sandbank to the other side.
Yeah.
There's also a monument there. I mean, how authentic, I don't know, but there's one on the other side in Arabia that is now in a museum in Arabia, apparently.
Right. Two things. Firstly, I can't get the verse exactly, but somewhere in Isaiah, when it mentions this act, it says, and God also built a highway for them.
Yes.
Once he'd parted, so there's a sort of sandbank. It's as though God then gave them an easier route across, yeah, rather than have to go all the way down.
Yeah.
We weren't
able to get a visa over into Arabia at the time. Otherwise,
that was the question. How long ago was this?
How long ago?
Yes.
Probably.
Only roughly.
15 years ago.
Okay, because it's only in recent times that Arabia has let people into that area. They've now shown an interest in developing it.
Ah, right.
And will open it up to the international community a lot more.
Okay.
And you're quite right, getting a visa, these people that have gone and done this investigation, one of their problems has been getting to the other side
of
the Arabian country. So, again, that does sort of fit. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Okay. Yes, I've read all about this as well. To meet other people who also are not sucked totally into the traditional thing, to the exclusion of all other
people. When you say you read about it, a particular book or just...
Yes, and I can't remember the name at the moment of the chap.
Okay, well, the book that I've reviewed, which hasn't yet gone out, was by Joel Richardson, and it's called Mount Sinai in Arabia, or Sinai in Arabia or something.
Yeah.
There's a much bigger scholarly one, which a friend of mine said, oh, are you aware of this? Because he was sort of looking at it. And I said, no. And then there's been one or two others that, I won't call it a bandwagon, that sounds a bit disparaging, but there's a lot of people suddenly become interested now in this and are writing about it. And it's becoming more accepted within sort of scholarly circles.
Yeah, Bob Cornuke was the one. I met him years ago.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of very interesting research.
Yes, I think that's the name I read in this other guy's book.
Yeah.
Cornuke.
So if you wanted a
good idea.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Mountain of Rock.
Okay. Do you want to spell his name out for us?
Yeah, it's Cornuke.
Okay, right. I'm sure fairly soon, if you keep your eyes peeled to the Prophecy Today review thing, or you want to follow this up now, Joel Richardson, who's written several good books that I've looked at and reviewed before, his book is just called the Sinai in Arabia, or Mount Sinai in Arabia, and that's much more accessible to read than some of the great detailed ones. I'm saying that one isn't very good either, but I want to follow this up. Now, I want to follow it up with one point, unless someone else still has a question or comment on this.
Yeah, there was a TV program about this, showing you all this stuff, some time ago on television.
Yeah, on like the Discovery Channel or something like that.
I can't remember, no, it was on normal TV, I don't have...
Okay.
It's just on, I don't know, ITV or something, I can't remember.
Well, I saw the programme because they were sort of pitting two very genuine Christians who were interested in this, who had very different views. And one of them was, you know, the Aqaba sort of side. Another one was said, no, it all happened way back, or very close to Goshen, in the Bitter Lakes area. And that was where the miracle happened, and that's where the Egyptians were drowned.
Mm.
So on. I mean, other interesting features about this to think about is that how long had they left before Pharaoh suddenly decided, oh, I shouldn't have done this, I'll send my chariots after them. And how quickly did they catch up? Could they have got as far as Aqaba? Well, they probably could if they didn't set off immediately chasing them and so on. And again, it might depend upon how many millions of people you've got to try and get across that route. So,
well, doesn't scripture say that they were held up by the fire, the wall of fire?
The Egyptians were.
Yes.
I don't know. I was just going to point out that, of course, the Israelites were guided in whatever route it was, but we now don't know.
Yes.
They knew where to go because of the pillar of cloud and fire. The pillar of fire and the cloud.
Pillar of fire, yeah.
Maybe it did hold the Egyptians up as well, but I mean, it's a mighty act. With all these unknowns that we probably never going to fully know, we don't need to. We can just marvel at this tremendous thing that God did. Absolutely essential, and the great miracles involved in this. Anyway, to finish this little bit. Someone seemed to know where Mount Sinai was, and that's the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
Now, in Galatians 1:17, you might remember that he says that after he was converted, he didn't immediately go and meet with the apostles, but he took himself off for 3 years to Arabia. Well, that's in Galatians 1, worth finding, because we're going to move on from there. So, Galatians 1:17 tells us that Paul went to Arabia. And you notice, though, that later on in the letter, in chapter 4, verse 25, he comes up with a statement, Mount Sinai
in Arabia.
Yeah. Now, people then debate, so what exactly did he mean by Arabia? What was Arabia then? It's a bit of a flexible term. But you could sort of puzzle out the fact, why did he go to Arabia in the first place? Did he actually go there to preach the gospel? Maybe, but there's no sort of record of that. But it wouldn't be surprising if he did. To evangelize the what would be the Nabataeans in that area, and so on. Did he go for a sort of big retreat and solitude? Did he have to really spend time with God? Did he go to this place because he knew that's where Moses and Elijah had been, and he was therefore realizing that it was, a key place for a Jew to go and, you know, find out things from God? And if so, where exactly did he think it was then? Now, what he's mentioning in Galatians 4 is using this sort of analogy, the context of Hagar and Ishmael, comparing it to Mount Zion, the two covenants as well. So he's doing what we've called a midrash on this sort of thing. He's busy trying to make a point about the two covenants and so on, and referring to the two mountains, Zion and Sinai. But where did Hagar and Ishmael actually go and settle? Well, they settled in, we learn from the scriptures, called the desert of Paran, and then in where the Ishmaelites were, which is down that side to the south and east of Israel, where there's Edom, and into modern Saudi Arabia. So maybe Paul is again picking up that Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia, because that's where the Ishmaelites also went to settle. So there is a little clue there in the New Testament that you can read Galatians a great deal and miss that point as part of the bigger picture of what God was trying to say about all this. Now, I want to come back to the other feature, which I said I would come back to in the last 20 minutes, but any further comments on what we've said so far?
So, guys, I've got to go now, so I'll see you next week.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Bye for now. Well, what I want to do is to come back to this verse in Exodus 12:38, which was mentioned a long time back. All these other people that seem to come with them, who presumably therefore were Egyptians, some of them may also have been slaves. They may have decided, oh, here's a chance to get out. But actually, in order to go with Moses and the Israelites, you've got to have come to a certain decision. And that decision, basically, if you like, is that their God is bigger than our God. In other words, they actually want to join in the people of Yahweh. They had seen all these miracles. They'd experienced, presumably, the Passover, and maybe lost their firstborn or knew people that had. And so they decided to switch sides, if you like, and get out at this particular point. So these other people, it's fascinating to follow them through and see who they were, who they might have been, and what actually happened to them. They eventually become known as strangers, aliens, sojourners. Strangers and aliens, i.e. basically non-Israelites. And they become known through the Hebrew word, which I'll pronounce as ger, if I've got it right, which were ways of explaining, obviously, Gentiles. But at this point, the word Gentile wasn't really a proper sort of word for this. It referred to non-Israelites who either traveled with them or eventually dwelt amongst them, maybe temporarily, or maybe they settled, but they had no inherited rights compared to the homeborn, who would be Israelites. So it's the first case of God attaching Gentiles to his people because they wanted somehow to become part of that covenant. And later on, these became known as the God-fearers, if you've heard of that phrase. And I'll mention that again a bit later. Some people, eventually, Gentiles, decided to go all the way and convert to Judaism and become full proselytes. In order to do that, you had to be circumcised in order to become fully part of the Jewish scene. But many, many more, and estimates are that by the time of Jesus, when we get to the New Testament, there was a million or more God-fearers scattered throughout the Roman world. In other words, Gentiles who found Judaism attractive for one reason or another. Maybe they liked the monotheism of it. Maybe they liked the ethical side of it. Maybe they liked the praise and the worship. So they wanted to be attached more loosely. So they were like semi-proselytes. And therefore they became known as God-fearers. Where they didn't have quite the same obligations and quite the same privileges, but they were allowed to be part of what God was doing. Obviously, a sort of well before the new covenant, where Gentiles come fully into all this. So out of that, you've got these other people. And the first thing to say about it is that certain commandments upon the Israelites were that they had to treat them well. They were not to despise them. They were not to oppress them. They were to pay them properly when they did their work and so on. So it was part of the ethics that Israel had to come to terms with, was not to look down and despise these people. But if we've got time, let's have a look through some of these verses. Look at Exodus 12:43-48. Because you'll have read all these things before and almost certainly not thought about the alien, the resident alien, the stranger, the sojourner, however it's described, they just sort of get tacked on and lost in all this. And the first bit here is about, well, you tell me, what do you find in those few verses in Exodus 12, 43 to 48? What's it really about?
The Passover. That's circumcision.
Well, it's the Passover, okay? And the point is that if a Gentile was to take part in Passover, they had to be circumcised, okay? But they weren't forced to, okay? But basically what God is doing here is he is protecting some of the key things of Judaism. So some things that these, call them aliens if you like, were allowed to do and not allowed to do, God was choosing things that they couldn't do if it was some of the main things of Judaism. If you look in chapter 12, verse 19, though, there's another little feature here, and that's something that the aliens had to do, which relates to Passover. Can you see what that verse is saying? Chapter 12, verse 19.
You must eat flatbread.
Yeah. In other words, there was to be no what?
Differentiation.
No leaven.
Yes, that's right. In other words, the rule about leaven had to apply throughout the whole land. So the alien had to fulfill that as well. Okay? It's almost like God is protecting his people here. He couldn't allow the non-Israelites to have a different set of sort of rules for this or a lower standard. Because otherwise it would be very tempting then for an Israelite to say, oh, well, it perhaps doesn't really matter so much after all. It doesn't really apply. So the bit about leaven, not to be found anywhere, would include the dwelling of the non-Israelites. But these non-Israelites were not allowed to go further. Well, they were obliged to do the leaven thing. They were not allowed to go and participate in Passover unless they were circumcised. And in fact, the verse in chapter 12, verse 49, which is repeated in Numbers, oh, I think I've got that wrong. I think it's 9:14. You need to turn to it anyway, but it's there in this Exodus 12 passage we're looking at. It will keep referring to a single law. Which means, does literally mean one law, not the whole law, but one bit of it. There cannot be one law for the Israelites and one for the others. It wouldn't work otherwise. In Numbers 15, again, a collection of verses there. So in Numbers 15, it's worth turning to verses 13 to 16 and 28 to 29. And while you're looking that up, it's just worth saying, because we're not going to look this bit up, but when it came to Sukkot, building the booths and so on, it was optional for the stranger, but not compulsory. The Israelites had to build these booths. As far as the non-Israelites were concerned, it was something they could join in on, but didn't have to. Now, what's the context of these verses in Numbers 15 then? What's this all about, just generally? What's it referring to? You see?
Law. One law.
Yeah, one law about what, though?
Well, there are offerings.
Yeah.
Offerings.
It's when you have blundered and not kept one of God's ordinances.
Okay.
You may be released from your unclean status, I suspect, by making the prescribed offering for that particular...
Okay, but that's details. So it's to do with sacrifices and offerings. If a non-Israelite wished to make a sacrifice, he had to do it in the Torah prescribed manner. He had to do it in the same way as an Israelite would. There was no lesser version for the non-Israelite. See, it's still, whatever the law is on this, it will apply to them as well. Again, you can see God is preserving and protecting what he wants the Israelites to do. If he allowed the others to have a lesser version, then the Israelites would think, oh, perhaps we can do it that way as well. Okay? In Leviticus 24:16 and 24:22, and this is dotting around a little bit now, if you want to take the trouble to find these verses, Leviticus 24:16 and 24:22, again, the main point about it, and the context this time is equality before the law, and it's to do with injuries and blasphemy and so on. Again, the same law will apply. The same law will apply. So what God was doing was putting them under certain parts of the law, but showing that they didn't have to or couldn't take on other aspects of it. And we'll try and see what that's about in a minute. This one's interesting, Numbers 35:15. I'll give you a moment to look up Numbers 35:15. What's this about?
Oh, cities of refuge.
Yes.
And places for the Levites to live.
Yes, well, cities of refuge. So were the non-Israelites allowed to go there?
Yeah.
Yes, they were. Okay, so they had the benefit as well. If they also did something and then needed to flee, or, you know, do something and fled, the cities of refuge were open to them as well. So this was part of the benefit of being attached to Judaism, even in this particular way. We won't look up all of these, but in Leviticus 17, this selection of verses is to do with ritual purity, and the only reason I've picked out verses 8, 10, 13, and so on, is that it talks about the alien as well, whatever word it might use. And in these matters of ritual purity, they have got to do things the Israel way. Again, it's just saying they must do the same thing. So we needn't look all those up. But here's another one that is interesting. If you want to turn to Deuteronomy 14:22. Now here's something that's a bit different for him. I've been pointed out in the Leviticus 17 things that he must do everything the Israel way. What's different in this verse?
The alien might eat something that has self-died.
Self-died, okay.
but of course the people were not, the Israelite people were not permitted.
Exactly. So this is one difference in the sort of dietary side of things, that a stranger alien may eat what is forbidden to an Israelite. If they come across something that's already dead, because it hasn't been killed properly, the blood drained and so on, so an Israelite can't touch it. It does say, I think, an Israelite can sell it on to someone else, and they can actually eat it. So they were not put under quite the same law there. Now, here's a really fascinating one. What's Exodus 23, verse 12 about? Exodus 23, verse 12.
the son of your female slave and your stranger get refreshment at the same time as you do.
But what's it actually about then? What's the topic?
Sabbath rest.
The Sabbath. Okay. So the non-Israelite is not forced to rest on the Sabbath, but he may not be forced to work. Okay? The Sabbath commandment, which is given to the Israelites, means that they cannot force their Gentile slaves or hired labor or whatever to work. The non-Israelite participates in Sabbath as a sense that he benefits from it because the Israelites do, and they're not allowed to impose upon them. But again, they are not forced to keep it in the same way. And in fact, obviously, a full convert had to obey everything. But these are the ones who are not full converts. Later rabbinic understanding of this was that a non-Israelite could not work for a Jewish person on the Sabbath, but he could do his own work on the Sabbath. Okay, so maybe he worked for the Jewish person, the Israelite, for 6 days, and then he was allowed a day off, but if he wanted to work his own thing then that would be fine. That's the way the rabbis actually talked about it in those terms. One of the things that comes out of all this, and it's a bit of a generalization, perhaps, but it meant that basically the non-Israelite had to keep all the prohibitive commandments, the ones that said you can't do this or you can't do that. But they didn't have to do the performative ones, the ones where the Israelites were told they must do this or they must do that. I say, it's an overgeneralization, but perhaps a better way of trying to understand it is that some of the commandments are called sign commandments. That's sign as in, this is what sets the Israelites apart as a sign to the other nations, the real identity markers. And the ones that the real identity markers would be the Sabbath and circumcision, and eventually later things like putting the mezuzah on the doorpost and things like that. A non-Israelite was not bound by those. And in fact, in some ways, if they went around being like that or doing those things and not having converted fully to Judaism, that would be frowned upon as though they were simply trying to copy it in their own way instead of being fully committed to it. Okay, so there were certain things that were bound upon them. That was to make sure that Israel didn't suddenly have a secondary set of laws of a lower standard. But these non-Israelites didn't have to, in fact, were not meant to, take part in things that were specifically there to set Israel apart as a special nation. Yeah. Unless, of course, you join them completely. So, whenever you're reading this part of the Bible in future, and you just keep your eyes open for this little phrase, then the alien, the stranger, the resident alien, whatever it is, and just now be aware that there's quite an issue going on around all this. And it was an issue that eventually was going to come into play in the New Testament when Gentiles were brought into the New Covenant and what they had to do and not do. Interesting extra little thing here. Two more things to finish with. Here's some verses from the Psalms. And if you could find them all and keep your fingers in them, because it's another one of the effective things. So it's Psalm 118, verses 2 to 4. Psalm 118, verses 2 to 4. Psalm 115, verses 9 to 11, and then 12 to 13. There's a reason to do it in two bits, but Psalm 115, 9 to 11, and 12 to 13. And then in Psalm 135, verses 19 to 20. So, say, if you can manage to sort of keep your fingers and flip them backwards and forwards, there's a pattern about each of these. If you look at them, they, each one of those, the first bit is to do with Israel. Let Israel say, or the house of Israel, or Israel trust in the Lord, and so on. And then the second part is to do with the house of Aaron, or in one of them, it's also the house of Levi. But there's a third group in each of them, which talks about those who fear the Lord, those who fear the Lord. So, for instance, in Psalm 118, let Israel say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let those who fear the Lord say, his steadfast love endures forever. Why do we get this third one in there? You've covered all of Israel. You sort of narrowed it down to the house of Aaron. And then it's those who fear the Lord. Well, isn't that everybody? Isn't that back to the whole house of Israel? Aren't they all meant to fear the Lord? Yes. Or maybe this particular verse is for the Gentiles who have become God-fearers and who have therefore attached themselves to Jewish worship and are taking part in this. So they also have to say and do the same things here. They must also say his steadfast love is just ever. They must also trust him. They must also bless the Lord and so on. Not sure about this, but it's interesting that suddenly those who fear the Lord might be a separate, smaller group of these so-called God-fearers, people who are not fully Jewish, but are taking part in Jewish worship. And then I've got one more thing to finish with. One thing's in two or three bits. But and this is in the New Testament. And if you come across the term God-fearers, then you will know that this is where it does crop up. But I put John 12:20, first of all. John 12:20. Again, you'll have read it time and again, but whether the impact of it was quite struck home. Who were at the feast?
Greeks.
Yeah, it says here Greeks, and of course Greeks means, in this case, Gentiles, isn't it? Non-Jews, in other words. So what were they doing? Specifically, they went up to worship at the feast. Well, these would be God-fearers. These would be people attached to Judaism, not full Jews, but who would go to worship at key times. And the point about the passage here is that they came to Philip with the request, "Sir, we would like to see Jesus." So they were showing an interest in Jesus. But why were they there? Not just sort of on holiday or something, but because these would be part of these non-Israelite people who were joined on. And the most significant God-fearer, of course, is Cornelius. So in Acts 10, verses 1 and 2, and again in verse 22, when God first converts the Gentiles and Peter goes to the house of Cornelius, in Acts 10, verses 1 and 2, it says that Cornelius and all his family were devout and God-fearing. And that isn't just a nice sort of little phrase thrown out there. It means that he would be in some way attached to Judaism in this looser way. And in fact, he then tells you how. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. So he kept two of the sort of ethical sides and religious sides of Judaism. So is that how God started to bring the Gentiles into the new covenant? People who already were sort of halfway there through Judaism. Verse 22 of Acts 10, he is a righteous and God-fearing man who was respected by all the Jewish people. That's why he was respected by all the Jewish people, because he was attached to them as a God-fearer. And the last verse is in Acts 13, verse 26. Where Paul is preaching, And he seems to refer to three groups of people here in Acts 13:26. Brothers, children of Abraham, and you God-fearing Gentiles. So here again, there is a group, the Gentiles that are called God-fearers, and Paul is attaching them to brothers, children of Abraham, and you, God-fearing Gentiles. Now, I could have said earlier that if you became, as a Gentile, you became a full convert to Judaism, you were then known as a son or daughter of Abraham. You took on the title of Bat Avraham or Bar Avraham, son or daughter of Abraham. So maybe, although children of Abraham would also refer to Jews, maybe Paul here is saying brothers, meaning fellow Jews, all converts to Judaism from non-Israelites, from Gentiles, and those Gentiles who are simply God-fearers at that level. So perhaps he's including all three. But of course, the middle one, children of Abraham, can be a bit ambiguous because it can refer to literal children of Abraham, Jewish people, or those who are fully converted. So that's brought us to a conclusion on all this stuff that we've been looking at to do with the Exodus onwards and who came out and who went where and when and how many and all the rest of it. We haven't solved all the problems, of course, but I hope it's helped us to read the Bible a bit more effectively. Sort of thing again.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, of course.
When you're on about the sacrifices and things, and the Gentiles had to obey the same laws as the Israelites, you know, there's going to be a third temple.
I'm not picking this up very well. I'm not finding a question yet. Sorry.
Okay. I'm thinking back to the sacrifices where the Gentiles had to obey the same laws as the Israelites if they were going to do the sacrifice.
If they were going to do sacrifices, they had to do it the same way at that point in their history, yes.
Right.
I'm not saying what then became in the New Covenant, because, of course, all the sacrificial thing changed, even for Jewish believers. So you can't take this model, which is an interesting thing to study, and say it then applies to all Gentile believers in the New Covenant, because everything changes in the New Covenant. So although I believe that when the Jews were first trying to sort out in the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15, how you incorporate Gentiles into the early church, which was still very Jewish, they had something to go on in terms of what God had decided in the past about it, but they're very much aware now that this was a totally new situation because they were all in Christ. So they were working it through again. And the only sacrifice is to try and see if this is where you're coming from in this, that we then have to make are not the sacrifices of the sin offering and the burnt offering and so on. They're the sacrifices of thanksgiving and of praise and of worship. So again, Gentiles are meant to do it in the same sort of way. But none of us now make those other sacrifices before. So, and that may not have fully answered your question, but I felt I wanted to say that's part of where you're coming from. Is there a bit more on this then?
Yeah, you've really answered a bit. It's just that the Jewish population, because they're expecting the Messiah and there's the third temple, they're going to institute sacrifices again.
Okay, so they're going to go back into an old system. But the point is that no Gentile now needs to ever attach themselves to that again, because they can come into the new covenant and, you know, become in Christ. In fact, it would be ridiculous now for anybody to say, oh, I'm a God-fearer in that lesser sense of, you know, I'm joining myself to what the Jews are doing. We're still meant to be God-fearers in the bigger sense. Of course, the New Testament still talks a lot about fearing the Lord your God, and so on. So, which is why those psalms can still refer to us, if you like, that third group can now be Gentiles, because we also fear God, but not in this sort of umbrella term that was used before. Any other questions or thoughts or comments?
Yeah,
Really very interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, should we,
really good.
Should we close the recording now then?
Yep.